Chapter 5. You don't live in Japan for 5 years without learning something about fish. So even though I had grown up on Mars, I knew what a shark was. I knew what a shark looked like, and I knew what the meat tasted like. Quite good, actually. And I knew that you could use the skin to make expensive boots and jackets that were practically indestructible. The reason they were practically indestructible is that a shark is practically indestructible. And just as people ate sharks also ate people. Only, they were better at it. I'd never seen a great white, but I had heard some frightening stories. The shark was one of the oldest life forms in existence. They were around long before we were, and they'll probably be around long after we are gone. In spite of everything we had done to our oceans, sharks survived. Sightings of great whites were pretty rare, but occasionally one of them would come up to the surface and eat a boat or something. Thought of a 65-foot great white shark living inside a hollow asteroid in the system of 61 Cygni, about 65 trillion miles away from its natural habitat, was astonishing in itself. The thought that I would soon be in there with the damn thing was frankly terrifying. We took a small shuttle from Draconis Base to the aquarium. From the outside, it looked nothing like an ordinary asteroid, even though it had started out as one. Most asteroids were potato-shaped and pockmarked with craters. This one was spherical from the hollowing out process, which involved using a solar mirror to bore a hole down into its center, placing water tanks within the asteroid's core, then spinning the asteroid and mirror heating it to its melting point. As the asteroid softened and melted, the spinning action pulled it into a spherical shape, while the tanks within the core slowly heated up, finally exploding from steam pressure. The resulting expansion caused a much larger, hollow, spherical asteroid with a thin crust, the interior of which could be sealed with ferroplast. The result was a finished shell for a space colony, ready for interior construction. Only in this case, the engineers of Draconis Base had used it to create a huge orbital humidarium and fish hatchery. Rather than leave the asteroid spinning to impart artificial gravity to it, the engineers de-spun it so that the environment inside would be zero-g. The atmosphere within the aquarium was a breathable one, though quite high in humidity. It was obvious that the SS Commandos had invested a great deal of time and love in their project. It was practical as a food source, but it had its aesthetic side as well. The inner asteroid was divided into sectors, carefully controlled, pressurized environments, misty and ethereal. It was like swimming through a waterless sea. You could float, breathe, and talk without aid of any special apparatus, and do it all side by side with schools of brilliantly colored fish. They floated everywhere, tumbling lazily end over end, swimming in their weightless, waterless ocean. Nutrients were misted into the air. Hydroponic plants undulated upon reefs made to resemble coral containing artificial caverns teeming with marine life. A sargasso of sculptured struts webbed the interior of the chambers. Struts containing pipes to mist the air and release nutrient fog also doubled as hand and footholds. It was like some sort of surreal, undersea children's monkey bar jungle.
"My God,"
Stone said.
"I've never seen anything so beautiful."
Sergeant Major Harris floated beside us, using a small, portable directional thruster to control his weightless flight.
"We weren't allowed to go down to the world below," he said, "so we created our own out here. There's nothing like it anywhere. It's taken years to get it like this. A lot of us spend almost all our off-duty time in here. It may seem kind of strange, but to me, this feels like home."
I remember what I'd heard about there being genetic material from dolphins in the SS hybrid matrix, and decided that it didn't seem that strange at all. Even I, whose genetic matrix had been dictated by eons of chance, felt spiritually moved in this spectacular environment, and oddly at peace. But then, we'd all come from the sea. Perhaps there was some vague, far-off echo of an instinct responding to a primeval call across the centuries.
"These fish are all hybrids," Harris said. "All designed to survive in fresh water. Or maybe I should say fresh air."
He grinned.
"It's pretty moist air, though. It takes a lot of getting used to. Look over there,
he said, pointing down, or at least down relative to where we were. Stone and I looked in the direction he indicated and saw an honest-to-God shipwreck on one of the larger reefs. The wood was rotting, and there were gaping holes in the hull. A sheared-off smokestack was sticking out at a crazy angle, and corrosion was turning the brass fittings green.
I don't believe it,
I said.
That's my pet project,
Harris said.
We call it the Titanic. A bunch of us have been working on it for almost a full year now. It's completely to scale. We've almost got it right.
He waved to several people who were working on the wreck. He led us through into another sector, and it was like floating through a Nautilus chamber.
You're about to meet our great white mascot, he said.
Stone glanced at him anxiously.
You're sure this is safe?
You can never be sure of anything with sharks, said Harris. But he should have been fed by now, so he probably won't be feeling very hungry.
I heard somewhere that sharks were always hungry, I said.
You heard that too,
Harris said.
Well, maybe we shouldn't get too close then.
He's putting us on,
said Stone.
Isn't he?
I reached out and immediately grabbed her arm. At the same time, I used my thruster to immediately reverse my direction. The air was suddenly full of sharks. There were dozens of them, all different sizes, all different species. The Sergeant Major was floating right into the thick of them.
They don't seem to be bothering him,
said Stone, swallowing hard.
I don't care, I said. I'm getting us out of here right now.
I'm sure the audience would be disappointed.
Mondego's voice came to us both simultaneously on tachyon broadcast through the interface.
How often would they have a chance to confront a 65-foot-long extraterrestrial giant great white shark?
How often would they want to? I said.
Let's go,
said Stone, hinting her thruster and pulling me forward with her. That little voice started speaking to me as we floated into that mist of all those sharks. This can't be real, it said. You can't actually be floating in midair with a school of sharks tumbling all around you. It's like some sort of macabre, surrealistic painting. It can't possibly be real.
Oh my God,
said Stone as we floated through the school of sharks, following the Sergeant Major down toward a reef. Only, it wasn't a reef. It was moving, floating in the mist like some giant zeppelin. Harris looked tiny floating beside it, like some remora fish. He waved us on.
Meet Winslow,
he said. He patted the monster.
Say hello, Winslow.
That huge maw opened wide, and every last nerve fiber in my body went berserk. At the sight of that vivisectorium, primitive racial memories sent waves of stark, raving terror screaming up from deep within, and it felt as if a giant fist had closed around my heart and started squeezing. I panicked and hit my thruster, accelerating back the way we came. I thought I screamed, but no sound came out. My mouth was open, and mentally I was screaming, but even my vocal cords, that's what it says, but even my vocal cords, had frozen with fear. I slammed into one of the struts and rebounded off of it, tumbling wildly end over end. I hit one of the smaller sharks, and we both spun off in opposite directions. I kept tumbling until a couple of commandos on duty in the aquarium caught me. Harris was there almost at once, pulling Stone along with him.
I'm sorry about that, sir,
he said, sounding as if he truly meant it.
These sharks don't attack humans. We've bred it out of them. You're perfectly safe here.
I feel like an utter fool, I said, humiliated in front of Stone.
It's my fault, sir,
Harris said.
We'd best be returning to the base.
No, I said. I tried to avoid looking at Stone.
Not yet. I'm going back. Go on ahead, sir,
Harris said.
We'll just wait here.
The man understood. You take centuries of civilization, and all that it's accomplished and what you have, at best, is still a thin veneer. And it doesn't take much to wear away that surface. You never really know what will strip away the layers of control until something happens that trip hammers the adrenaline and opens up the sluice gates, letting the primordial instinct gush forth out of the depths of your subconscious. There's nothing rational about it. I had simply reacted. Now, there was another primitive emotion at work, not quite as powerful or overwhelming, but equally undeniable. The man had shamed himself before the woman. The hunter, the protector, had deserted the keeper of the cave and the bearer of the children, leaving her to the mercy of the predator, while he abandoned all responsibility and fled to save his own miserable skin. It made no difference that in the modern world, those simple roles and definitions made about as much sense as carrying a spear. Deep down inside, there was still a vestigial machismo that said, "Thou shalt not reveal thy yellow streak before the woman and fail to defend her from the scary monster." So maybe I was being foolish. Maybe I didn't need to prove anything to Stone, who certainly did not require the likes of me to protect her. And maybe I was only putting on a false show of bravado for myself more than for anybody else. Now that I knew Winslow wouldn't eat me, I could go back and conquer my fear. It was all a lot of nonsense, but I had to do it anyway. I took a deep breath and hit my thruster. I started drifting down toward that impossibly huge and terrifying fish, which didn't seem any less terrifying, despite the fact that Harris told me it didn't attack people. But I had made up my mind that I was going to do it, no matter what. I set my teeth and tried to control the unreasoning terror that welled up in me at the mere sight of that awful thing. I had to keep telling myself, it doesn't eat people. It only looks frightening. It's nothing but a pet. It's just big. That's all. And then that little voice started its Judas whisper. "It's a hallucinact," it said reassuringly. "You're only frightened by a vision in your mind. None of this is real. Go on. Nothing will happen. You'll see. There's nothing to it. It's just special effects." I reached out a tentative hand to touch the giant shark, literally feeling my flesh crawl, then involuntarily jerked it back at the last instant. And a plasma blast slammed into that thick gray hide, pushing the shark away from me as it thrashed, sending great globules of blood bursting out in all directions like dark quicksilver. For a moment, I didn't know what the hell was going on. I was struck by bubbles of shark blood that burst against me, and then I suddenly realized that somebody was shooting at me. I heard Stone yell something, and I fired my thruster, sending myself toward one of the struts. It hit, and I rebounded, spinning away just as another plasma blast slammed into that strut, shearing it and sending globs of pressurized water and nutrient solution spewing out in all directions. Someone dressed in the uniform of an SS commando was accelerating through the air toward me, firing a plasma pistol. But with every shot, the burst of plasma coming from the gun sent my attacker flying back in the opposite direction, and he had to quickly use his thruster to compensate and correct his glide path. I saw Harris give Stone a hard shove, which sent him flying in the opposite direction, and then use his thruster to accelerate toward my attacker. A couple of the other commandos were also closing in, but they were unarmed, and the assassin ignored them, concentrating on me. He was having a difficult time in the zero-G environment, and that was the only reason I was still alive. Harris got to him and landed on his back. They went spinning end over end together, but the assassin managed to dislodge Harris and, with a kick, sent him spinning back to the other approaching commandos, which resulted in an abrupt change in his direction. I had nothing I could use as a weapon, but then neither had the soldiers. There was no reason for the commandos to go armed in their own fish park, yet they were risking their necks going after the assassin unarmed while I was running away again, trying to hide behind an artificial reef. Common sense and a well-developed instinct for self-preservation told me to stay exactly where I was and hope the commandos got the assassin, but I just couldn't do it. I was furious. I couldn't run away again. And somehow that plasma pistol didn't scare me half as much as those giant shark jaws had. I pushed off from the reef and went sailing toward the assassin. He was having a bit of a hard time shooting in zero-G, but he was learning fast. He fired at one of the commandos, and the opposing reaction sent him flying backwards. But the plasma charge took the commando squarely in the chest, and he exploded into bits of charred flesh and globules of blood and body fluids. The assassin fired his plasma pistol again to change direction, and now he was coming at me fast, aiming. I hit my thruster and rocketed sideways just in time. The plasma blast barely missed me and sent him flying backwards into Harris. They struck each other and rebounded in opposite directions, spinning away. And then one of the sharks thrashed around and took the assassin's right leg off with one snap of its powerful jaws. The man screamed horribly as blood bubbles burst out from his severed arteries. The sharks were all going crazy. They were thrashing around, spinning crazily and tumbling end over end through the air, their jaws snapping at anything within reach. Another shark bounced into the assassin, snapped his jaws, and his right arm went floating off into the air, spraying globules of blood behind it. Harris grabbed me from behind, and I was suddenly being pulled through the air, away from the grisly scene as he screamed,
"Get out! Get out! Shut down the sector!"
We went rocketing through the Nautilus chamber, and several other soldiers came through right behind us, the last one pausing to close off the chamber and shut down that sector of the aquarium. I frantically looked around for Stone, saw that she was safe, and then the reality of that man being torn to pieces by the sharks came home to me, and I did something nobody should ever do in a weightless environment. I puked my guts out. Colonel Wren was not sorry to see us leave Draconis Base. I couldn't really blame him. Two of the men under his command had died. I hadn't killed them, but if I hadn't been there, they'd still be alive. The assassin had killed one, and the second man was killed along with the assassin when the sharks went wild with blood frenzy. In spite of what Harris had said, you can only manipulate so much genetically. The smell of blood had been the feeding signal for sharks for thousands of years. The sharks in the aquarium were bred outside their natural habitat and raised in a controlled environment on nutrient solutions and bloodless protein. They were very different from the sharks on Earth, but they still shared a common evolution. The smell of blood had awakened a deeply ingrained instinct. I tried to convince myself that none of it had been my fault. I tried real hard, but I couldn't quite buy the argument. People were dying around me. The number had gone up to 3 now, starting with that young bandit shot down by Sakara's gunmen. If I was going to count the people dying back on the Ginza in a gang war, which, in a way, I had initiated, that number would be a lot higher. It seemed as if the only good thing I had accomplished since coming to Earth was a new start in life for Miko and her family. Maybe it wasn't much considered in the balance, but at least it was something. And then there was Stone. If she had been right next to me when that assassin made his move, she might have been killed as well. That was the second time her life was placed in jeopardy, simply because she was with me. Breck was right. The only thing to do was to take care of Sakara. The trouble was, so far I hadn't shown much aptitude for taking care of things. My leprechauns had pulled me through somehow, but my Russian archbishops were predicting that my run of luck couldn't last much longer.
"You're being very quiet,"
Stone said as we rode the Skyhook shuttle to Casino, the largest of the Fire Island habitats. "I think I lost more than my lunch back there," I said.
"Don't be so hard on yourself, O'Toole," said Breck. "You've managed to survive a jungle campaign and 2 assassination attempts. That must stand for something, surely."
"It stands for pure dumb luck," I said, fighting back my anger at his mocking tone. "I've been extremely lucky to have survived this long. If it wasn't for you that night in the hotel, both Stone and I would probably be dead now. As for that jungle scenario, I was so scared. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And the same thing happened back there in the aquarium. I panicked."
"You don't think I was scared?"
said Stone.
"I was so terrified I couldn't even move. I didn't do anything to help you, did I? Or isn't that my responsibility?"
"Come on, Stone," I said. "This isn't a sex role thing. Well, maybe it is to some extent, I'll admit that. But it would have made no difference if you were a man. The fact is that my fear overcame everything else."
"Fear is a perfectly normal human response to danger,"
said Breck.
One which you don't seem to have,
I said. Breck shrugged.
I am not a perfectly normal human. I was designed not to feel fear. Fear is a function of self-preservation. It is nothing to be ashamed of.
Well, that's easy for you to say. You've never felt it.
I don't need to experience fear to know something about it, Breck said. I've seen it many times. SS hybrids are fascinated by fear because it is an emotion we cannot feel. I have experienced the fear of others through the interface, and while it isn't the same as feeling it myself, I think I have an understanding of it. I often wish I have the ability to feel it, because it's clearly a profound experience. Evidently, you can only feel so much fear at any time. There seems to be a sort of limit, beyond which the mind either disassociates or turns you completely and shuts down your systems, making you die of fright. When the disassociation occurs, the mind retreats somewhere within itself and becomes essentially dysfunctional. But sometimes you reach the limit of your capacity for fear and you self-protectively and quite consciously shift gears into some other emotion. It could take the form of sexual excitement, for example, or it could manifest as anger. An anger so intense that a terrified man pinned down by enemy fire can suddenly charge the enemy batteries in an unreasoning fury. Heroes were often very frightened people. Do you recall what you felt like in the jungle when you made the jump into enemy fire? You were clearly afraid, but you acted with courage, with heroism. You were driven by your fear, and you did what was necessary to survive. Now, consider what occurred back there in the aquarium. You fled from that shock and terror, yet you went back to face it again.
Sure. After I thought it was safe, I said.
But did you go back only because you thought it was safe?
Breck said.
You were still afraid, but you went back because you were angry at the fear you felt. A phobia is not a rational thing. People who are claustrophobic are capable of understanding intellectually that they are perfectly safe within a closet, that there's nothing in there that will harm them. Yet, try confining someone with claustrophobia to lock themselves inside a closet. You can open it for him, show him that there is nothing harmful in there, go in there yourself, and lock the door to demonstrate that it's safe, but you still won't get him to go in and lock the door. His fear controls him. He practices avoidance. That isn't what you did, is it? You used your anger to overcome your fear. You have been experiencing fear incrementally ever since you first arrived on Earth. And you're growing more and more adept at coping with it. There is an old saying, what does not kill you makes you stronger.
Somehow I don't feel stronger, I said. In fact, I'm more aware of my weaknesses.
The more aware you are of your own fears,
said Breck,
the more you understand them and the less power they have over you. You're being called upon to use resources you have never needed to develop before. Did you expect it to come easily?
I guess I hadn't thought about it that way, I said. Thanks, Rudy.
For what? He said. I'm not trying to do you any favors. We are on a team, and you will not be much use to us if you're distracted by agonizing over your masculinity. I would rather you concentrated on the job at hand.
Stone shook her head.
You just can't do it, can you?
She said.
The moment you start to show any sensitivity, you have to ruin it somehow.
I am only trying to keep things in perspective, Breck said.
a touch too nonchalantly, it seemed. I had a feeling an old issue between them had been skirted.
But at least we know one thing. This is no illusion,
he turned to me.
It's entirely possible Mondgo could have programmed an illusory attempt on your life into this scenario if it were ein Hallucinact, especially after what occurred at the hotel. But he could not have fooled me, this ein illusory Bill Wren. I've spoken about things only he and I knew, things nine player master could have bullied out of my mind without my knowing it. So, you can postpone your paranoia about induced hallucinations. This is nine hallucinacts. Whatever it is we'll find down on Draconis, it is going to be real.
Casino was a sphere about 1 mile in diameter, roughly the same size as Draconis base. At its poles were the massive external radiators which removed heat from the interior of the habitat and surrounding it like a planetary ring was an array of mirrors directing sunlight through windows near the rotational axis. It was a small habitat by modern space colony standards. The design was originally meant to house between 10 and 15,000 people, but according to Colonel Wren, Casino held at least three times that number. It was crowded. Casino, like Draconis Base and the other three habitats which made up the Fire Islands, it started out as a tachyon drive spaceship. During the late 20th century and the early part of the 21st, there had been much debate about which was the more viable option for the human settlement of space. Terraforming, or the construction of island colonies. Each side had its champions, and the planetary engineering types were often fond of dismissing the island colony proponents as bubble-headed counterculture dreamers, while the island colonists regarded the terraformers as planetary chauvinists, reactionaries bound by inefficient and outmoded ideas. But, as so often happens, the optimum solution was one of compromise. Humanity evolved upon a planetary body, and while some people eagerly responded to the challenge of creating a Bernal sphere and living in an island colony, most people would always prefer life upon a planet with its own unique challenges. Some pioneers didn't mind looking up and seeing a town hanging upside down above them, but many found the effect psychologically disturbing. They preferred the vista of a sky and the challenge of taming open spaces. Terraforming was a long and complex process involving finding planetary bodies, or creating planetary bodies, with enough mass to hold an atmosphere and asteroids for use as the building blocks of the new world to provide materials for an atmosphere, to reshape the surface by impact, or to spin up a planetary body to the desired rotation, following which organisms would be introduced to begin the process of establishing a biosphere. Sometimes, it was necessary to dismantle smaller planetary bodies, moons, or even planets themselves to provide the raw materials. These things took time. The people who began the work would not live to see its completion, nor would their children. And they needed a place to live while the work went on. The advent of tachyon drive made it possible to build an island habitat and use it as a starship to take the pioneers out to the world they planned to tame. Ironically, the planetary engineers would wind up living out their lifetimes in an island colony. Their children would be born and raised there, and they would continue with the task. And when the world was ready for human habitation, those who chose to go down to the planet's surface would do so, while those who chose to remain in the island colony would supply the technology and industrialization to get the new world off to a good start and keep it going without the damage to the biosphere that Earth-based industry had wrought over the centuries. Such had been the plan with Draconis 9. But when Eurocon pulled out after the disaster, the island colonies remained. They could have been refitted for space travel and transported to a new terraforming project, but what made it more cost-effective for Eurocon to sell them was the discovery of fire crystals on the surface of Draconis IX. Fire crystals possessed many of the same properties as diamonds, only they were harder and more precious due to their rarity. The first discovery of fire crystals occurred when an asteroid containing them was found in the system of 61 Cygni. Not only did they turn out to be superior to diamonds for industrial purposes, but their haunting beauty and rarity placed them in high demand as precious gems. Supposedly, they had some sort of mystical, talismanic quality. I had never seen one. That's seen with three E's. Fun typo. Or known anyone who had one, so I had my doubts on that score. But one thing was certain. The value of fire crystals was enough to make some people abandon everything and emigrate to the Fire Islands, in spite of all the dangers. The habitats originally meant to house the Eurocon planetary engineers were now home to a wild agglomeration of adventurers. Wherever the prospect of wealth existed, there came those who sought it, and those who came to exploit the seekers. Cassino was a densely packed orbital city of crystal hunters, saloon keepers, whores, gamblers, thieves, murderers, and slavers. It made the Ginza Strip seem tame. The entire habitat was a space-borne combat zone. There was no more law in Cassino than there was in the frontier boomtowns of Earth's Gold Rush. Ideally, island colonies were designed to be self-supporting with their own industry and agriculture, but Cassino had neither. Every available inch of space was taken up by buildings and by people. In the beginning, the island colony plan was followed according to design, but the steady influx of people seeking to get rich soon upset the balance, and the companies controlling emigration to the Fire Islands were less concerned with the living conditions in the habitats than they were with the potential profits. Only one of the island habitats now had agriculture, and there was some support industry, but it had become increasingly necessary for everything to be imported. Draconis Base was self-sufficient, but life in the Fire Islands was an expensive proposition. That suited the operating concerns just fine. They could maximize their profits by running the island habitats as frontier company towns. There was a high turnover. Many of those who went down to the planet surface never returned. Some achieved their dreams of wealth and left, but far more became trapped by the harsh realities of life in the Fire Islands. Many died in the habitats themselves. It was a rough neighborhood, full of predators. Those who couldn't pay their way found that there was no shortage of patrons willing to extend them credit. But this credit was not given for altruistic reasons. In the Fire Islands, people were a commodity, like everything else. You borrowed against your freedom, and if the marker was called in and you couldn't pay it off, you had a very simple choice. Die or become someone's property. You couldn't go to a third party and borrow to pay off your marker because the human sharks were very careful about things like that. The moment you establish credit with a shark, he became your banker, and the information was logged in the computer banks. Other bankers consulted their computers before granting credit, and they couldn't poach on one another's interests. Something like that could be fatal. You either paid off your banker, or he foreclosed on you. Colonel Wren was caught between a rock and a hard place. If it was up to the military, the Fire Islands would be closed to immigration, but it wasn't up to the military. The military had no economic clout. The corporations operating the habitats did. So long as the quarantine was preserved, which was the unenviable job of the Special Service, no one cared much what went on in the Fire Islands. Consequently, it was hardly surprising that Colonel Wren did not care much either. However, he had cared enough to allow Psychodrome to show people just what life was like here, in the hope they would discourage would-be immigrants. He felt confident it would. We got a briefing, and then we were on our own. Our experience was supposed to frighten people off. I did not find that very encouraging. Our Skyhook shuttle docked with Casino, and we entered the habitat through the zero-G access corridor at the rotational axis. We floated through the corridor to the point where it branched out into the axial passageways leading into the habitat. There were directional signs over each of the corridors, and we took the one labeled 3rd Avenue South, Administrative, Downtown Residential, New Arrivals. South meant toward the zero-G access corridor and the docking areas. North was uptown. Up, the inner surface of the sphere toward the opposite pole. The main corridor continued onto a point at the approximate center of the sphere, where a club called the Arena was located. In the early designs for island colonies, this area was set aside for low-gravity swimming pools. Imagine a spire extending out through the corridor of the sphere, inside of which was the zero-G access corridor. If you think of the habitat as a hollow candy apple on a stick, then the docking areas would be at the end of the stick, and this spire would be that part of the stick which went inside the hollow apple. From where we entered the habitat, the top of this spire was straight ahead of us. From the point of view of the residences on the inner surface of the sphere, it was straight up at the sphere's center. Surrounding the top, or end of this spire, was a ring, the inner surface of which had held the pools in the early designs. The rotation that gave the habitat its gravity also kept the water in the pools from going anywhere. But the intriguing design meant that, just as the residents on the inner surface of the sphere could look up and see other residences overhead, so could swimmers in the pool look up and see other pools overhead. Because of the decreased gravity near the rotational axis, it was not only possible to jump off a diving board straight up into an overhead pool, it was also possible to execute porpoise-like leaps out of the water. Casino, however,
had no pools.
Instead, there was the arena, where the ancient concepts of the Roman circus had been given a new twist. Bankrupts, as the unfortunates who borrowed themselves into slavery were known, sought their freedom as low-gravity gladiators in the arena. The habitat was aptly named. Once again, I had the feeling I had bought into a game I could not afford. I hoped there'd be a large audience for this one. I wouldn't want Colonel Wren to be disappointed. If it had been up to me, I would much rather have gone straight down to the planet's surface from Draconis Base. Not that I was anxious to get there, but I was anxious to get this over with. Only the idea was to give the home audience an authentic experience. New arrivals did not come to Draconis Base. That was closed to ordinary civilians. New arrivals came into Casino, made residence arrangements, and then tried to learn the ropes. No one was allowed to emigrate to the Fire Islands unless they had at least enough funds to get started. What happened to them after that was their own concern. The only thing that the operating corporations cared about on Casino was collecting bills. And they did not tolerate late payments. I had been on island habitats before. There were several above Mars. Those, however, had been much larger than the Island One design of Casino. Still, even taking that into account, Casino was not quite what I had expected. It made me think of a modular Manhattan bent in around itself, with all the skyscrapers cut off. Constructing tall buildings inside a Bernal sphere wasn't practical design. With anything much over several stories high, there was a decrease in gravity, which increased with the height of the building. Most island colonies terraced their residents, or if population density was a consideration, arc cube or other module types of architecture were employed. On Casino, this did not seem to be a major consideration. There were no skyscrapers, of course, but there were many multi-story buildings. What the hell, just pack them in. Who cares about their comfort? Long-term health and psychological effects? Why bother? If they want decent housing, let them pay for it. We didn't go through any sort of customs inspections. That was all handled on the other end. Everything that arrived at an island colony arrived clean. It wouldn't do to introduce insects or plant blights or whatever into a controlled environment. So pre-embarkation decontamination procedures were pretty thorough. However, one look at Cassino made me wonder why they bothered. There was no pollution, of course, but they didn't go to any trouble to keep the island clean. I began to see what Colonel Wren intended. Even at first glance, Cassino did not look particularly inviting. We followed the signs to the administration complex, where new arrivals were to check in, obtain their residence assignments, which had been paid for prior to embarkation, confirm their credit, and pick up their orientation kits. It was a typically bureaucratic procedure, hurry up and wait in line. But we were quickly spotted, and it became apparent that we were not going to be treated as just any new arrivals. We were descended upon by a tall, well-built, handsome, and clean-cut character with dark brown hair and a knee-jerk smile.
Mrs. Winters, Mr. Breck!
I thought for a moment that I was being ignored, but the slick hadn't forgotten me.
And you must be Mr. O'Toole! On behalf of the Draconis Combine, I'd like to welcome you to Cassino!
It didn't take a genius to figure out who this guy was. It was immediately clear that this was Cassino's answer to Bob Steers. It figured. Travel 65 trillion miles, and one of the first things you run into is a PR flak. This must have been what the 20th century tree huggers, pardon me, environmentalists, meant when they warned of mankind polluting space.
My name is John Rudman, corporate liaison for Cassino and the Fire Islands community. We've been expecting you. If you'll follow me, I'll see what I can do to expedite your arrival.
I thought we had already arrived, but who was I to argue? Breck looked amused. Stone looked at me and rolled her eyes. Slick Rudman launched into a snappy patter monologue on the wonderful opportunities to be had in the Fire Islands. A monologue I was able to tune out without a great deal of difficulty. He led us to an office suite in a modular complex, past secretaries who gazed at Breck with undisguised admiration. He was a star, after all, and a dashingly handsome one at that. And I noted that some basic facts of life had been exported to Cassino from the corporate womb of Earth. Where women were excluded from the corporate power structure, the men in key positions always selected from the ranks of the drop-dead beautiful for their secretaries. Women who didn't fit the template didn't have a chance. It didn't matter that the position was almost completely obsolete, with computers able to do virtually all the work required. There was, and probably always would be, a certain cachet to having a human subordinate to command, and the desirability of that subordinate was supposed to say something about the superior. Nor were corporate women any different. When they reached the same positions of power, they often behaved exactly like men. The office door opened onto a plush suite with a small garden beyond it on the other side of a set of sliding glass doors. Those doors were open, and Slick conducted us through the office and out onto the garden patio, where an older version of himself was seated at a circular glass table. They didn't look alike, but they were cut from the same cloth. Office people. Soldiers of the corporate army. This one was a senior officer, however, complacent and secure. White hair, blue eyes, crow's feet, and worry lines from the ascent to power. Executive fitness cultivated through exercise rather than hard work. He wore a dove gray jumpsuit and a huge fire crystal pendant at his throat. It was the first such gem that I had ever seen, and it was indeed spectacular. It really seemed to have a flame burning inside. I couldn't take my gaze away from it as I watched it flicker from bright red-orange to violet-blue to amber-green.
Ah, I see our stellar crystal hunters have arrived, he said, getting to his feet and extending his hand to each of us in turn, starting with Stone, whose hand he held a bit longer than I cared for. Mrs. Winters, Mr. Breck, and of course, Mr. O'Toole! I'm Carson Sonoma, Chief Administrator for the Draconis Combine Casino. Do sit down.
He gave some sort of signal to Slick Rudnan, and the flack nodded and departed hastily.
I do wish I had the opportunity to greet you personally when you first arrived,
he said, smiling.
But I'm afraid our Colonel Wren co-opted that privilege. I trust your stay at Draconis Base had been pleasant? You know, as a civilian, I've never even been there. It must have been a fascinating experience for you.
It was interesting,
Stone said.
Tell me, Mr. Sonoma, do you make a habit of personally welcoming all new arrivals to casino?
Naturally not, Mrs. Winters,
he said smoothly.
But you must admit that you three are not just any new arrivals. You are celebrities, bringing your experience to countless people, some of whom may one day decide to emigrate to the Fire Islands and seek their fortune here. Consequently, the Draconis Combine felt compelled to issue, through me, a statement as it were. I understand that you are eager to proceed, so I will take up as little of your time as possible.
We appreciate that, Breck said. The sooner we are able to go down to the planet's surface, the sooner we can attain our game objective.
Quite so, Mr. Breck,
Sonoma said.
Therefore, I will get right to the point. Your home audience should understand that there are fabulous opportunities to be had here in the Fire Islands. But, as with most things in life, you get nothing for nothing. The Draconis Combine runs this operation in the spirit of free enterprise and adventure. People who come out here are held back only by their own limitations. Life in the Fire Islands is not without its risks, but to those individuals who seek more out of life than the drudgery of living by the clock, there is limitless stimulation to be found here, whether one chooses to become a crystal hunter or to engage in any one of the many extraordinary service occupations casino has to offer. Life here is fast and hard and thrilling. To those who can meet the challenge, there is the potential of great reward.
As if absent-mindedly, he played with the fire crystal at his throat, turning it so that its inner flame danced brightly. I imagined the scene back on Earth, where the home audience was plugged into their sci-fi sets, dreaming dreams of burning fire crystals, buying their way into a better life. Sonoma was playing the scene for its maximum publicity potential, turning us into an advertising medium. You can have one of these, he was saying. All you have to do is squirrel away enough to buy your way out to the last frontier, where men are men, and women like it that way. The message was, come and live the fantasy. It was corny as all hell, but a lot more potent than anything Wren had to say. There was a little bit of Hakeem Sakara in our friend Sonoma.
Colonel Wren didn't seem to think that life out here was especially rewarding, I said. Colonel Wren has my greatest respect,
Sonoma said.
And I won't attempt to patronize you by pretending that life is easy and that people don't occasionally get in over their heads. Fire crystals are not simply to be found lying on the ground down on the planet's surface. And it is expensive to live here. We offer a unique lifestyle, complete with unique pleasures and luxuries. The cost is high, but you get what you pay for. Sometimes people act irresponsibly and overextend themselves, foolishly abusing their credit privileges. We cannot afford to support those who will not carry their own weight, and our system may strike some as a bit harsh. But keep in mind that those who have bankrupted themselves is no one but themselves to blame. Still, they work hard and apply themselves. They can earn their way out of their bankruptcy. Everyone has a chance here. What you make of it is up to you. What about the Draconians? Said Breck. What chance do they have? With a man such as yourself, very little, I should imagine.
Sonoma said, smiling broadly. He had misunderstood the question, though I didn't think he had misunderstood it on purpose. He wasn't the sort of man who would be very much concerned with the welfare of the natives. And it didn't seem probable that he had ever been down to the planet surface himself. He didn't strike me as the kind of man who took the sort of chances he spoke of. Breck did not pursue it. There would have been no point in antagonizing the man. We simply allowed him to finish his little speech uninterrupted so that we could get out of there as soon as possible. Rodman was waiting for us outside Sonoma's office, full of cheer and excitement for us and ready to conduct us personally to our residence. I wondered briefly if it was possible to conduct someone impersonally, and I supposed it was, but Breck quickly put a stop to that idea.
I appreciate the offer, Herr Rodman, he said, but I think we would prefer to find our own way.
That nonsense, Rodman said. I wouldn't think of it. Besides, you're new here, and it can be quite confusing.
They do have our orientation kits, said Breck. And don't forget, the idea is to give the home audience a taste of what it's like to come up here and experience the adventure for themselves. Having company officials giving us VIP treatment really would not do. We wish to give the home audience the authentic thing, the undiluted essence of Cosino, and seen from the point of view of ordinary new arrivals.
Yes, certainly. I can understand that, Rodman said quickly. If you would allow me to direct you, then.
We'll find our own way, Stone said, giving Rodman one of her media smiles. Thank you ever so much, John. You've been wonderfully helpful.
We left an unhappy Rodman behind and proceeded outside on foot along Third Avenue, heading uptown.
The Combine seems anxious to put its best foot forward, I said. Why do I feel like a company recruiter?
Because that is the role in which Sonoma sees us, Breck said. But I fully intend to give the home audience the authentic experience of Cosino, whether the Zacronus Combine locks it or not.
That isn't why we're here, Rudy, Stone said. I appreciate that Colonel Wren is an old friend of yours, but let's not lose sight of our objective. We came here to get a fire crystal. The game scenario is the important thing. I should think you'd be the last person who'd need to be reminded of that.
I need no reminding, he said curtly. I fully intend to win this game, but I will not do it at the expense of being used as a salesman for the Draconis Combine.
Does it really make any difference?
She said.
I know how you feel about Draconis 9, but you're allowing the past to interfere with what we have to do in the present. That's what Mondego wants. We can't afford to waste any time. Remember, we may have gained an early advantage, but there are still some other teams competing against us.
I'm well aware of that, said Breck.
Are you aware we're being followed?
I said. Stone glanced at me quickly.
What?
We kept on walking. Breck frowned.
Are you certain?
Reasonably.
Who is it?
Breck said, without looking around.
That idiot Rodman?
No. Someone dressed in a black jumpsuit. Shorter man, more heavily built. I suppose he could just be heading in the same direction as we are, but then why would he be so careful about it? I've only caught a couple of glimpses of him while I've been rubbernecking like a tourist. Maybe I'm being paranoid, but he seems to be staying out of sight the rest of the time. And doing it damn well, too.
If we are being followed, I was not aware of it, said Breck. And that is not good. That is not good at all.
End of chapter.